When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
This podcast features graphic details of real events taken from letters written by inmates convicted of murder. Listener discretion is advised.
I want you to know, I'm not a monster and crazed convict. I'm a man who tries to move forward every day in this pit.
These are the written words of Texas inmate number 045-41884, Tracy Duke. They're taken from letters that he wrote to us throughout 2019.
Going on 30 years, I try to do all I can to put anything I can back into life in this world.
My name is Zoe Hines. And Tracy Duke is one of over 2,000 inmates that my colleague Ned Parker and I have corresponded with in our work as documentary producers. This particular episode is unique because I went to meet Duke in a state penitentiary in Texas, a place called Beeville, and I'll be telling you all about that experience.
This is Letters from a Killer, a Podimo podcast. Episode 3, I Confess.
The vast single-story building first catches your eye from a distance. Rural America steps aside, making way for gun turrets and razor wire. Your brain starts doing laps around a checklist. Paperwork, ID, outfit. Leave your damn phone in the car. Passport shown, bags checked, body checked. Protocol takes over. Until finally, you sit and wait to be escorted through all the gates and corridors and locks. And that's when your mind returns to the real task at hand. On the other side of those anti-hostage chambers, sat behind a 2 meter square pane of glass, is the individual that you've been writing to, the man or woman you've travelled thousands of miles to meet, who ended another human's life. It's time to come face to face with the person behind the pen.
I've got a lot of hate built up inside me, because I've been abandoned all these years.
This is a more emotionally charged episode for you, Zoe, because Tracy Duke is someone who you actually met. Tell us a bit about Tracy. What were the questions and themes that his letters raise?
So the most important thing you need to know about Tracy Duke is that right from the very beginning, and over the course of his letters and in person, he's been incredibly frank, very open. It's always been very clear that he wanted to talk. So open, in fact, that he did reach a point where it seemed like he was trying to confess to murders that he hadn't even been tried for.
Okay, well, that's a pretty unique situation. Why was this? What exactly was going on?
It's really complicated, and we will try to address that in this episode, but if I'm being honest, I'm still trying to understand it to this day. If Tracy Duke was looking to get our attention, surely there were better ways than confessing to murders.
But this does help us with the theme for this episode, which is the idea of confessions and can they actually be trusted? But before we explore Tracy Duke's letters, let's hear the events that led him to a life in prison and the details of his case file.
Letters from a Killer. Case file. The following details are taken from official press reports and court documents. October 1989, Fort Worth, Texas. Tracy Duke, his girlfriend Brenda, and partner in crime Stephen Staley enter a steak restaurant. Unknown to staff, this was the 16th restaurant the trio had eaten at in recent days, and the 16th they'd held up at gunpoint. After calmly eating dinner and dessert, Duke, Staley, and Brenda pulled out two Mac 11 9mm semi-automatic pistols and demanded the wallets of all 30 of the restaurant's customers and six employees. The robbers demanded that the manager reveal himself. This was the 35-year-old father of three, Robert Reed. Nudging his assistant managers to make sure they remained silent, Reed stepped forward. As Staley forced the restaurant manager to open the registers, an employee slipped unseen through the exit and called the police. When the police arrived, a frantic Staley threatened to murder Reed, accusing him of pressing a silent alarm. Reed calmly assured the criminals that there was no silent alarm and bravely offered himself as a hostage if they agreed to leave the customers and his employees alone. Agreeing to these terms, the gunman led Robert Reed from the restaurant and made their escape in a hijacked car. A high-speed chase ensued for 20 miles, until disaster struck for the escapees. The stolen vehicle malfunctioned, and police apprehended the trio on foot. After arresting the robbers, police made a grisly discovery. Sacrificing himself in return for the safety of his customers and staff, father of three, Robert Reed, lay dead, shot point blank in the head and chest.
There's a lot to this case that we want to try and unpack.
It sounds like a very American crime. And visually, the idea of robbing these diners and taking the wallets, it makes you think of scenes in Pulp Fiction. But these are a series of crimes with a really tragic end, and you can't help but think of the restaurant manager, Robert Reed, and how brave he was to put his life in danger in order to protect the lives of his customers, people who, in all likelihood, he didn't even know.
Let's explore an extract from a letter that we received from Tracy Duke back in 2019.
Duke had, at this point, signed a consent form, and he was very keen, it seems, to talk about his upbringing. Now remember, these words are read by an actor, but they are Tracy Duke's words, as written to us, from prison.
I was raised by my single mom, who worked two jobs to support two girls and three boys. Dad went off to Vietnam and never came back to us.
He explains how his girlfriend Debbie found herself getting into a drug habit.
So, to spend time with the one I love, I started to do speed and ended up losing my job. That was it. I started to steal everything to get high with her.
Duke admits to stealing, but when that didn't support their habit, he bought a crowbar in order to break into homes.
I started to do home invasions. I'd go to the doors of homes of dealers or nice homes and knock on the door. And my friends would run in and take all.
Duke explains that doing speed took him to the point of no return.
I was hooked bad, with no help. I even went to the store and got salt and sold it to a big dealer as speed. Pounds of it. Then, I had to leave California because it was not safe for me. So I went to Las Vegas and into six other states, robbing and some kidnapping and murders. I was scared. No one to turn to. No place to go. So I ran and ran.
So here we have the first example of Tracy Duke referring to some kidnapping and murders in his letters to us. And it's written within a sentence. He doesn't draw attention to it or elaborate on it any further, but he's using plurals here. And to our knowledge, he's only been convicted of one violent crime. And as documentary makers reading something like that, of course, you want to find out more.
At this stage, we're now writing with a convicted killer, and we are also conducting our own research. And I think the thing that we noticed right away is that the crime that he's convicted of is the only crime which relates to murder. So if there were previous murders, he has never, in fact, been convicted of those. There was nothing in his records at all which suggested that he had any previous form as a killer. So this was intriguing, but it was also quite concerning. But besides our somewhat concerned interest in Duke's references to other potential violent crimes, another element of his early letters really caught our eye. Duke goes into a lot of detail about his daily routine and what his life in prison is actually like, which, strangely, is not something that all inmates seem to want to write about.
One of the strengths of Duke's candour and his openness is that he really paints a picture for us about what life behind bars is actually like. And the fact that he's been in prison for 30 years means he's got some really interesting reflections both on day-to-day existence and on how to get through life in prison.
I cope with my day-to-day inside by helping others around me. I read books, learn to spell with a board game, Scrabble, and I now collect soda can tabs for the Ronald McDonald House. It's a cancer place for kids, and I've collected over 1,500 of them so far.
When asked about freedom, he says,
"What is that? I was a mixed-up kid on drugs with no way out. So freedom? I don't even know it."
Clearly, Tracy Duke has had a lot of time to think about the importance of family. And in his next letter to us, he writes with brutal honesty about his own.
"My family abandoned me when my mother passed away in 1995. Tell them they have left their little brother to rot in prison, with no family, love, or support. I've got a lot of hate built up inside me, because I've been abandoned all these years. All of 99% of inmates have. I'm sorry. I am a little bitter at times, okay? But I was only a lost drug addict who went astray. There is one thing I do. I accept everything I did."
It feels as if Duke is writing to us in a very open, very confessional way. And that makes me feel that we've got a really good opportunity here to be able to learn a lot from him. But of course, what we're asking him about principally are the crimes which saw him sent to prison. And before he talks specifically about the murder of Robert Reed, it's clear that he wants to spell out how it was his co-defendant, Stephen Staley, who led him to that place. Duke starts by telling us a completely different story about how he first met Staley when he was trying to sell his girlfriend Brenda's truck.
"Staley came to buy it with ones, fives, tens, and $20 bills, rolled in two boots in his car."
Somehow, that meeting led to a friendship between Tracy Duke and Stephen Staley. But Duke is keen to tell us that from the start, Staley was getting Duke involved in his criminal behaviour. He explains that Staley believed a business partner had messed him about, and that Staley had a plan for this man, which was
to off him. "I didn't think Staley was for real, but he made a call and told his partner to meet him."
Staley asked Tracy Duke to accompany him to a rendezvous, where he then killed his business partner, a man called Davis, in Duke's presence. Tracy Duke then claims that he was cajoled into committing more crimes with Staley after accidentally picking up the murder weapon and leaving his fingerprints on it.
"He said, 'If you do not go with me, I'll call the cops and tell them the gun is at this place and you will go down for murder and the rest of the crimes he did with the gun.' So I was scared. I wanted to stop. I also wanted to kill him to take all this away. But he, Staley, had the gun someplace I didn't know of. I felt traded, and I felt lost and scared and wanted to do drugs again to take it all away. But I had Brenda and the unborn baby to think of. All I knew is I did not want to go to prison. He was full of mind games for this young dude."
So when you first read that somebody accidentally picked up a murder weapon and got their fingerprints on it, naturally you're going to be cynical. I can remember reading this and thinking, come on, really? You've been so open with us about your childhood, you're seemingly being so open about witnessing this crime and your pregnant girlfriend and your drug problem, and yet you are asking me to believe that you had no agency in getting involved with these violent crimes that Stephen Staley trapped you into being part of this violent spree which ultimately led to murder.
Working in this field can become quite complicated because we're reading these letters written to us directly from convicted killers, and we have no idea if the events detailed in them are true or not. We can't tell if what's being written to us is real or just purely fabricated lies. From the way that he's been apparently open and honest, do you have an inclination to believe him, or is this just a leap of faith too far?
At this stage, I can remember being very, very cynical about who this person was and about what he was telling us about his involvement in the crime that sent him to prison. According to Tracy Duke, Stephen Staley pressured him into taking part in multiple armed robberies, and that's what led to the plan to rob Steak and Ale, where Robert Reed was the manager.
I was a pupil of Steve's from day one, the first killing to the end. He wanted to do another job to have more dollars from meth, and Steak and Ale was that job. They said I shot Mr. Reed and two cops and missed, but I did not. Staley did. I should have shot Steve and left it, but I did not. P.S. Bring me a cheeseburger or pizza slice when you come visit.
When an inmate offers a third party into the narrative, we always have a duty to explore that connection and find out what we can about it. In Stephen Staley's case, we knew that he was a co-defendant with the death penalty as a result of the actions that happened in Steak and Ale in 1989. So from the moment we started looking at this case, we would have written to both Tracy Duke and Stephen Staley, and actually the third co-defendant, Duke's girlfriend, then pregnant Brenda, to ask for their take on what happened that night. And very quickly, we discovered that Stephen Staley was in a psychiatric facility and unable to engage with the media to give an account of his experiences as a result. And that really stopped things in their tracks.
We were writing to Tracy Duke about his conviction for murder, and here he is talking about identifying as a killer, but on the same page, he's explaining it wasn't him who actually took Robert Reed's life.
They said I shot Mr. Reed and two cops and missed, but I did not. Staley did.
For that particular documentary film, which was for the Netflix series I'm a Killer, we needed to work with inmates who have taken a life. That's the whole premise of the show. And in reflecting on Duke's case, we were actually becoming a bit stumped and beginning to think that there was no way that we could move forwards.
And then Tracy Duke starts to write to us about other crimes. He starts to refer to crimes that he hasn't been convicted of in his letters, and he starts to leverage that. Let me read you a quote. He says, "I want to do this for you and me. I'll give you all you do know about me, plus all my other crimes convicted on and not convicted on." Now, to a documentary filmmaker, that's a very interesting premise, but it's also a very concerning premise.
We are documentary makers, which is to say that we document things that have occurred and we tell that story. What we never want to do is to be a part of the story. But there are, of course, times when you have to make a decision about whether you are going to be involved. Obviously, if somebody is at risk, then you would step in and there are various things you can do. The point is that we are there just to observe. What we're suddenly getting now is the possibility that Tracy Duke is going to tell us that he is responsible for the murders of other people. And it might seem like an obvious thing here to say the responsibility for us documentary makers or for anyone is to report that, but we have a duty of care to everybody who participates in a project like this. Now, most often you are thinking about that in terms of the family of the victims themselves. You do everything you can to be considerate, but we do also have a duty of care to the inmates, to the murderers themselves. And being from the UK, where we do not have the death penalty, when we're making films about people in the US where they do have the death penalty, that presents us with an issue. If Tracy Duke is going to tell us that he has committed murders for which he has not been investigated and has not been convicted, and we are saying that we're going to broadcast that or to report it to the authorities, are we potentially looking at a situation where our actions could result in him being tried, convicted, and sentenced to death? But what's the alternative? To ignore it and the possibility that out there are families of someone who's been murdered but who would never find out the truth, it's really hard to know what to do, and we sat up late into the night talking about this. What is the right course of action in these circumstances? Tracy Duke hadn't been explicit in his letters, and what we didn't want to do was risk having him commit to paper by asking direct questions. So, Zoe, we decided in the end, didn't we, that the best thing to do was that you should go and see him yourself.
Nobody wants to hear that interviewing murderers is anything other than exciting and thrilling and scary. But as you know, Ned, when you do so as regularly as we do, certain parts of the process do become strangely commonplace. The prisons are all designed on a similar format. The searches, the checking through kit, all that kind of stuff. The sort of process side of things. If you asked me to reflect on the lead into that particular meeting, I couldn't, because that week we would also have been conducting other interviews. However, once I was with Tracy Duke, that was a different interaction to the others.
What did you ask him?
Oof, what didn't I ask him? I asked him everything about his case and about the other cases. I was trying to get to the bottom of what Tracy Duke had written in his letters. I was trying to get to the bottom of what he meant by being involved in other crimes and whether he had actually taken a life. But I think before we even got there, the first thing that struck me about him was the disparity between the way he writes and the way he carried himself in person, the man that was sat in front of me. I remember thinking, gosh, you are a very different person to the voice that I've become familiar with reading in your letters.
Was he a character that you felt you could connect with?
So when you're meeting with an inmate, you're there to do a job, you've got a certain amount of time, a certain selection of questions that you have to get through, but it is still an interaction, it's a human interaction. You're sat with a human being, and whilst you might want to backbench your own personal opinions and foreground the judgments you're making on a professional basis, of course, as a human, you do warm to some people more than others. Tracy Duke had been party to some very violent crimes that deprived innocent families of their loved ones. But the man that I was sat with was clearly a very different man to the individual who had committed those crimes 30 years ago. And I would say I did feel myself warming to him, connecting with him as the man that was sat in front of me. So it's a very complicated feeling.
But you were there to ask him questions, and the answers that he gave you could seriously impact upon his life, potentially could even end his life.
Yeah, first and foremost, I was there with a job to do, which was to ascertain what Tracy Duke was trying to tell us in those letters when he referred to his role in other crimes and what he meant when he identified as a killer. Did he literally take somebody's life or not?
Were you fearful about what he was going to say?
I'm always fearful when I interview an inmate. You never know what's gonna emerge, because the stakes are high because of what could be said and the implications for that person as a result of what you report.
What did he say in this particular meeting?
At that meeting, Tracy Duke confirmed what is widely reported, which is that he did shoot Robert Reed, but that his shot wasn't the fatal shot. Stephen Staley was the killer.
I was a pupil of Steve's from day one, the first killing to the end.
Clearly, Duke is not changing his story as far as his role in the murder which saw him sent to prison. But what about the other crimes, the other potential murders that he alluded to in his letters to us?
So sitting down with Tracy, it became very clear that although he does feel morally responsible for the loss of life, he hadn't been legally, directly responsible for any murders, which was a relief to us.
Was it just the case that in his letters he was trying to keep us interested in him? Why would he do that?
I personally think Tracy Duke was incredibly lonely and wanted the opportunity to be listened to be heard. And in some way, to try and clear what was weighing heavily on his conscience, even if that wasn't in line with the legal definition of murder.
But you left that meeting feeling comfortable that while we couldn't actually cover his story as a documentary in the series I'm a Killer because we didn't have access to Stephen Staley, we did at least know where we stood with him in terms of his involvement in any other crimes.
Yes, and I would have been okay accepting that and leaving it there. But what got really difficult in this case were the letters that came after. I remember his next letter starting, and I quote, "Mrs. Zoe and team, hello from TX. Your visit to Beeville was nice.
I told you that I'm in this for the long road. Because in the long road, someone may see a film of this and say, hell, I'm not going to do that stuff. I also think you guys should think of a new show that deals with the fall partner of killers and how they are doing in prison over 30 years or something. Or how their minds are played with and all, or misled. Some film on the ones who did not pull the trigger, as me, or kill, as me. I think it needs thinking on."
Duke had clearly been thinking about our meeting and the opportunities that a documentary might present in terms of sharing his story. His long letter continues and begins to take a persuasive turn. It seems like he's desperately trying to keep the possibility of us making a film about him alive. And to do so, he suddenly seems to be suggesting that we connect him to another murder, one separate from the Robert Reed killing. He starts to talk about a victim called Davis.
"Killing Davis. I told you the truth about my time, okay? But the news in the court case said different, okay? Plus, I did in court papers say I killed Davis. I gave you the truth of it all. But you can go with that murder if you'd like. Smiley face."
Putting aside the somewhat chilling use of a smiley face in this context, who is Davis?
So there certainly was a moment of confusion here where we were trying to ascertain exactly who Duke was referring to in this instance. But after a bit of research and some cross-checking, we did establish that Davis was actually the business partner that Stephen Staley had killed in Denver.
So this is the event where Staley allegedly threatened to frame Duke with the murder weapon?
Yeah, that's right.
"He said, if you do not go with me, I'll call the cops and tell them the gun is at this place and you will go down for murder and the rest of the crimes he did with the gun."
At this point in his letters to us, Tracy Duke appears to be using this event as leverage to get his story told.
"Is there any way you can go with the Davis killing and add on the Texas killing, since I did cop out to killing him in Colorado in 1991?
Duke had already told us about being present at this murder and burying the body with Stephen. But the point is, he's clearly desperate for us to tell his story and continues to try and make himself qualify as the murderer in this instance, so that we'll continue to correspond with him.
"So guys and girls, look at going from the Davis killing in Colorado to end up in Texas. I told you the truth in the interview, but Stephen Court said I killed Davis, as in the news. Can't we use his words from court and the news? And I'll do a new interview to make it good. I know we can do it. Smiley face."
Tracy Duke is, or at least was, a violent man, and that is exactly how he was perceived in the court of law.
Letters from a killer. The verdict. The following details are taken from official news reports and court documents. On October 20th, 1999, a jury found Duke guilty of aggravated robbery and attempted capital murder, and sentenced him to two further terms of life imprisonment to run consecutively to the capital murder charge. On May 7th, 2015, Tracy Duke submitted a writ challenging the cumulation of sentences. On December 8th, 2016, United States District Judge Reed O'Connor denied his appeal. Duke is currently serving three consecutive life sentences in Texas and a 30-year sentence in Colorado for murder and armed robbery.
So that murder and the armed robbery conviction in Colorado is in fact the Davis murder, the one that Staley was convicted of and that we already knew about, and which Duke in his letters had admitted to at least being a witness to, if not actively participating in it. So there is now no doubt that Tracy Duke was a man involved in violent and deadly crimes, but you still found yourself liking him when you met him.
And that's why it's a very complicated and difficult thing to work through, because in front of you is a person who's caused pain, who's taken a life, who's hurt innocent people. And you're trying to reconcile that with the fact that in your presence they're being personable, considerate, they're trying to help you, they're appealing to your sympathy, to your humanity. It is challenging, professionally and personally. In this episode, we've explored the letters of Tracy Duke.
I was a mixed-up kid on drugs with no way out. So freedom? I don't even know it.
We've learned that the job that we do does have an emotional impact. You can't just tell the story without it having an impact on those people whose story you're trying to tell.
I told you that I'm in this for the long road. Because in the long road, someone may see a film of this and say, hell, I'm not going to do that stuff.
I think the obvious thing that we can take away from hearing Tracy Duke's letters is that, to some extent, we can't judge an inmate by what they've written. His is the only example in this series where we've had a sit-down face-to-face with a letter writer, and it's a really good example of how your preconceptions, judgments made about a person on the basis of what they've written, can be complicated, challenged, deepened by meeting them in person and adding another dimension to that correspondence.
Tracy Duke was willing to implicate himself in crimes that he hadn't committed simply to have his story heard. And if that is how far somebody is willing to go just to have the opportunity to say the things that they feel need to be heard, then I think that we are doing the right thing by telling their stories.
Next time on Letters from a Killer. Becoming a killer.
Picture a 5 or 6 year old boy who many said was undersized for his age, getting kicked in the stomach by a 5 foot 8 tall, 300 pound grown woman. I always thought that my adoptive mother would kill me.
Letters from a Killer was hosted by Zoe Hines and Ned Parker and is a Podimo podcast by Transistor Films. Support the show by sharing on social media and following the podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.